We have one remaining case to be heard in oral argument this morning, and then one on the briefs. The case to be heard in oral argument is 20-3167, Bales versus Commandant. Mr. Maher, whenever you're ready.
Good morning again, Your Honors. It's a pleasure to begin here with you again. This case applies the very same law we discussed earlier this morning in the first case. So I thought it made great sense that it was docketed on the same day. However, I would like to begin my presentation this morning, Judge Holmes, by addressing your concern about what the right standard is to apply for an Article III jurist to determine whether or not to review the merits of an Article I military tribunal. And I believe you cited Watson the last time we had the pleasure to speak. And Watson involved a challenge to an evidentiary hearing. And an evidentiary hearing is not a right. It's not a constitutional right in the context of a 2241 case. However, the cases that we present now in Bales, this is a case, although it's a very tough case, admittedly, where the accused pled guilty to killing 17 Afghan civilians. There are two fundamental, completely constitutional, free from fact, no military implications to show why the military courts, the Article I military tribunals, did not give full and fair consideration or adequate consideration. And here's why, if I could break them down briefly. Mefloquine. It has now been determined by the United States FDA, by Roche, the manufacturer, and by the Assistant Secretary of Defense for Health Affairs to cause long-term psychotic effects. And as the medicine is unfolding and the science is unfolding, in addition to the psychological and behavioral aspects, it's eating brainstem tissue away. These soldiers were given mefloquine in addition or sometimes to the exclusion of doxycycline, another antimalarial drug, when they deployed to Central Asia and or to Iraq. Before the Army Court, there was undisputed medical evidence from the nation's premier expert on mefloquine who concluded, and his affidavit was accepted as post-trial after acquired evidence, that Sergeant Bales was, whom, by the way, had a fabulous record prior to the incident in question, 42 months in combat, married man, two children, acquitted himself well under fire. And if you were going with Bales, you're probably going to come home because he was a good non-commissioned officer in the U.S. Army Infantry. That evidence was discounted by the Article I Military Tribunal and for several reasons. There are at least seven. And if I may go through them, I think you'll see, I hope you'll see, that this is not the Watson instance where I didn't get an evidentiary hearing because of my habeas petition. This is the Constitution where the government had in its possession, custody, and control three important documents that could have shaped the entire landscape of the case, whereby Sergeant Bales, whether or not he was fit for trial, whether or not he was competent for trial, whether or not he was laboring under a disease or defect of mind on the night in question, whether or not he was a meaningful participant in his own defense, whether or not the appropriate charge was seeking the death penalty, whether or not there should have been a lesser charge, and to the crux of the matter, constitutionally speaking, whether or not his plea of guilty is knowing, voluntary, and intelligent. And here's why. The record reflects that a sanity board, which is the military equivalent of a competency board, that would be ordered to determine whether or not an accused is able to appreciate the nature of his wrongfulness and to be able to participate in his own defense. Nobody in front of that sanity board, ordinarily three medical officers, had the mefloquine evidence in front of them. So that brings a Brady violation up in three manners. They are these. First, the Food and Drug Administration issued a black box warning saying that mefloquine causes long-term psychological and persecutorial effects in an otherwise healthy population. Two, Roche, the pharmaceutical manufacturer, sent to the FDA when they learned that their medical evidence, that their product was administered to Bales, that he killed 17 people. which is a complete contrast to how this man, this non-commissioned officer, acquitted himself in duty. And then third, the Assistant Secretary of Defense for Health Affairs issued an order to all commands of the military, not defense, not Army, Navy, Air Force, Marine Corps, to all of defense, saying, stop administering Mefloquine. We are having trouble understanding the idea that it's having adverse effects on the ability of our soldiers and our personnel to carry out their duties.
Okay. Beyond, if there's time permitted, I'll re-engage with you on Watson. But right now, I want to focus on your Mefloquine argument. Why doesn't this just become a materiality issue? I mean, as I understand it from the court's opinion below, there was no testimony at all that he was prescribed Mefloquine. There's no testimony at all from anybody that he took Mefloquine. In fact, I don't think he ever said that he took Mefloquine.
I respectfully disagree, Judge.
Okay. On which one of those do you disagree?
On all of them. And I'd like to address each one of them specifically. There's an affidavit unchallenged by Sergeant Rejo, who was in formation in Iraq in 2004, who said we had Mefloquine Mondays where we had to stand in line and the medics would come and say, drink it and drop it. Meaning, and then those men would say, hey, we're going to have Mefloquine Mondays, meaning they're going to start seeing things and hallucinating and having those types of issues. Secondly, Dr. Stahl, a Harvard-trained psychiatrist, examined Bales and said, yes, everything I've seen here is consistent with his having been administered Mefloquine because his prior conduct, he acquitted himself beautifully. And then finally, the nation's premier expert, Dr. Remington Nevin, who has dedicated his life to Mefloquine, which is the generic name for Larium, to say, I've examined this man too. And I'm here to tell you, in his sworn affidavits before the lower court, meaning the Army Article I Tribunal, as well as the Article III court below, his expert opinion is everything is consistent with Mefloquine intoxication.
I like the word consistent, but point me to where he said, I took Mefloquine.
Well, that I cannot do, Judge.
Okay, you can't do that. Well, no. Well, beyond the Mefloquine Mondays, point me to where somebody specifically said, I saw Bales take Mefloquine.
Specialist Rejo's affidavit sworn, which was accepted before the Army Court of Criminal Appeals, the Article I Military Tribunal. Then
he says, I saw Bales, not just people standing in line, take Mefloquine and drop it. He saw Bales do it.
Yes, Judge. If you read the affidavit, you'll see I was standing next to Bales and all of us had to do it every Monday. That's what the prescription was. Some people say that they should have taken doxycycline. And the Army Court's decision in the Article I Military Tribunal, they make hay to say, well, there's no entry of Mefloquine in here. But was problematic about that, the United States had in its custody and control a report from the Assistant Secretary of the Defense saying, this is rampant. We have to stop this. We're administering Mefloquine, which we know has debilitating side effects for our personnel, and it's not being entered into the records. Those records are now before the Military One Tribunal and before the lower court. Now, by virtue of that, the impact on the fairness and the fundamental fairness of this trial is Bales pled guilty. He pled guilty because the United States was seeking the death penalty. And as you may know, and forgive me if I'm going over things you already know, but it's important to say, there's certain criteria under the law in order for a military commander to authorize the death penalty for an American soldier. So had this medical evidence been disclosed, the FDA report, the Roche report, and the Assistant Secretary of Defense report to the defense, and then more importantly, to the competency board, the evidence of Mefloquine intoxication would have been in front of the medical authorities such that their report could have been influenced to come back and say, I believe he was laboring under the debilitating effects of long-term psychotic effects. And this is important to know, Your Honors, the Army developed this drug. They developed this drug. The Fort Bragg shooting in 1992, the men were on Mefloquine. Otherwise, fine men. and with no prior records, and opened up fire on their own guys in a PT formation.
Let me understand, analytically, the box that this methylquin argument fits under. I assume that consistent that your argument is that we shouldn't stop at whether there was a full and fair consideration, and that we should reach this substantial constitutional question. In other words, this whole conversation we're having now doesn't relate to whether the military Article I court gave full and fair consideration, right?
Well, yes, it does, Judge, and here's why. They discounted all of it. Because it was unchallenged medical evidence accepted before the court by the experts, Dr. Stahl, Dr. Nevin, and by a young trooper who stood in line. So we put the evidence before the court. They discounted it, saying, well, it wouldn't have any effect whatsoever. But we all know.
If they considered it and came to a view that may be different than yours, but if they considered it and discounted it, why isn't that full and fair consideration? I mean, you know, Watson, even if you put that aside, the whole notion becomes we're not supposed to be. Let's assume your view about substantial constitutional issue. We look at that. Let's assume that for a moment.
Yes, Judge.
Even then, there is this threshold evaluation of whether there was a full and fair consideration, quite apart from whether we would have done it the same way. Do you agree with that?
Well, yes, Judge, in academically, but in practice, no, sir, I respectfully disagree. Here's why. The admission, the government's disclosure of their possession, custody, and control of those three reports would have empowered the defense and the sanity board to change the landscape of every aspect of the case. And I have nine of them. Our team put together nine impacts on page 45 of our opening brief to show why this is a critical and substantial constitutional issue, which deprived Bales of a fundamentally fair trial, because Brady requires the government, even in the absence of a defense request, to turn over information bearing on his mens rea on the night in question.
Not just bearing on, but material information. And as it turns out, if he, the person who's most incentivized to tell us he took methylquin, won't tell us he took methylquin, then I am struggling to understand why what some Harvard-trained expert said really matters. I mean,
here's why, Judge. Please. We can't hold Sergeant Bales to the standard because he's laboring under the psychotic effects as diagnosed by unchallenged experts.
So he doesn't know whether he took it because he's laboring under psychological effects? Is that what you're telling me?
Persecutory delusions, psychological effects, a TBI, 10 explosions, blown up. And at the time, he came in to save his life. So those are the problems. Secondly, and I see my time is running short. If I please get this before the court too, the United States flew 10 Afghan witnesses into the United States and brought them from the battlefield. And pursuant to a Freedom of Information Act request, we secured information directly from the Army showing that four of those people came into the United States with alias visas, false names, false social security numbers, that they were held out as government contractors and never performed a biometric analysis, which is ubiquitous, as the court probably knows right now, nothing more than fingerprints and DNA when a terrorist twists the wires because they leave fingerprints. And one of the main witnesses, Mullah Baran, number one, stood before the court because the prosecutor stood before the court and said, we believe he's a coalition detainee because he's related to terrorist activities. The defense had produced a report, and the defense had made specific defense requests asking for the BATS and HIDES. And those are the acronyms for the biometric data entry system. And I have personal experience over there twice, once as a soldier and once as a program manager, where we prosecuted the Taliban and the insurgent fighters using biometric data. And it is nothing more complicated than fingerprints and DNA. So when the defense asked for that information and was stonewalled because they said the State Department won't give it to us, well, all of us who served in government know that the DOD and the State Department work hand in glove.
All of this discussion still has to address that predicate question of whether we can, whether courts can review those decisions before the ACCA at all. And it depends on the argument that was made in the prior case that substantial constitutional questions are still able to be addressed. Isn't that right?
That's correct, Judge. And
well,
I would say
that predicate, and we argued it, I mean, we discussed it lengthily before, but that predicate is the front thing that has to be finally addressed.
Agreed, Your Honor. And in this case, it is addressed. I mean, how much more substantial, free of factual issues, no military issues are involved, and you're addressing the fundamental due process right to plead, to know how to plead. So,
but just to restate it, and you're over time here, but
sorry, Your Honor.
What you're arguing and what you're asking us to hold is that notwithstanding some of our recent 10th Circuit cases about if the question was briefed adequately, that's all we have to look at. You're saying that those cases, that language, if it's briefed, that's all we look at, that is inadequate to address the prior 10th Circuit law that says, no. Even if briefed and rejected, that you can look at it anew if it presents a substantial constitutional question free of fact.
I understand your statement, sir, and I believe you. Here's why. Some of the issues like Watson do not rise to the cornerstones of democracy and fundamental fairness. Cases like this, where you're depriving an innocent man who's presumed innocent from having a fair trial, and those trial rights are guaranteed by the Constitution, those are material and substantial. And even though the lower court might have said, well, fine, I don't, my hands are tied, this court stands as the ultimate arbiter to say what the law is.
Do we have to reverse any of our prior 10th Circuit law to agree with you?
No, I don't believe you do. This is a case by case. And that's what the previous 10th Circuit case law says, Your Honor, that each case is judged.
The case that said, that was what the cases originally said. But after Dodson and Watson, I think Watson quite just unequivocally said adequate consideration is presumed by briefing. Now, maybe you're saying, okay, you don't reverse that because it only says it's presumed, but they don't say it is an irrebuttable presumption. It can be rebutted by an inadequate addressment of the issue of a substantial constitutional question. Is that the way you try to protect? One panel cannot reverse another panel on this court. So I'm troubled about how you propose we get around those cases on this predicate. But I know you've overspent your time, so it'd be up to the presiding judge on whether you should even answer that question.
The presiding judge wants to hear him answer.
Thank you, Your Honors. Much obliged. And my position is this, which I believe is a correct statement of the law. If you look at Watson, Watson was asking for an evidentiary hearing before his habeas petition was denied. These men, these two cases before you today, they're asking about substantial questions of constitutional law that bear directly on fundamental fairness and whether or not the Constitution of the United States was present or absent without leave. Those, and the case law provides you and empowers you, justices, to say, well, that's an easy one. Okay, that guy, all right, fine. But when you get up, you rise to the level of jury instructions, the panel being confused, or in this case, a complete defense that would have changed every aspect of the case, and the United States had it in its possession, custody, and control, and didn't turn it over, how much more substantial and clear can we be? So this is a sliding scale.
This case, to me, presents a much harder issue than the prior one, because the prior case may not address a constitutional question. It simply addresses a question of harmless error, although it could be constitutional because it's not harmless error in the abstract. It's harmless error of a constitutional claim, which is a higher burden. So that one is more complicated. But this case is just, it does seem to me to be a pure constitutional case. You haven't really told me in a paragraph how we can distinguish our two earlier precedents that I'm troubled about, Dodson and the other one.
Well, here's how I'd answer that, Judge, and thank you for that. I would look at Monk and the reasoning in Monk. I would look at Dodson and the reasoning of Dodson, and then I would also look at the holding and dissent in Burns v. Wilson. All of that empowers this court to use your expertise as professional jurists to determine. Well,
would you rely on the fact that those later cases did not overturn the earlier cases, and therefore we have to still give them credit? I mean, if in fact our later cases were overturning them, we would have said so. Is that part of your argument?
No, Your Honor. The argument that I'm presenting this morning is get to the merits of the case. If you didn't get to the merits.
And yeah, okay.
All right. He's told us what he wants.
And if we get to the merits, I mean, how do we let it lie?
Yeah, that probably is right. That if we meet the predicate, that's probably right. The devil's in the predicate. But go ahead, I'm done. Thank you. You've answered my questions.
Thank you, Your Honor.
All right, Mr. Magg, we'll hear from you, please.
Thank you, Judge. Judge, I think the last point is probably the most salient point about what's really going on here. Counsel wants this court again to step in and sit as ACCA under the circumstances because he simply doesn't like what ACCA did. But I think it's important to note in this case.
And your argument is even if ACCA was clearly wrong on a constitutional issue, that was clearly a constitutional question. Your position is the courts can't look at it.
I think that's a hypothetical, Judge Bell, because obviously our position is that the court in reviewing the Brady claim was not clearly wrong.
It's not a hypothetical question at all. It may not be the only question in this case, but it certainly is a question in the case. So sure. Let me ask you then, is it your proposition that if we decide the ACCA was clearly wrong on a constitutional question, that we cannot review it if that question was briefed or argued to them?
No, that's not what I'm saying. And I made that very clear in our brief.
I think you did. That's why I'm trying to get it clear now in oral argument.
Right. So our position, of course, is the court is never precluded from addressing a constitutional question. The point to be made here is that the factors set out in Dodson, Lips, Roberts, and the ensuing cases gives the roadmap for the court to look at what guides this court as to whether or not it needs to question both the constitutional issue and any factual issues that it would otherwise address.
Okay. And the critical point there is that this, you are conceding that this is not a constitutional or a jurisdictional limit on us at all. It is a prudential piece of advice. Is that how you address it?
Yeah, I think that's a fair way to describe it as a prudential factor when you look at whether or not what is a substantial constitutional question. Now, I understand some of the concerns about what that means, but I think it's fair to say that if every constitutional question was a substantial constitutional question, there would be no substantial constitutional questions. The defense wants every issue to be a substantial constitutional question. Here, there was a question about whether or not Brady was violated by the government. That doesn't necessarily raise a substantial constitutional question.
Well, that's why I want to get clear on your response to Judge Ebell, because let's say that having looked at the Dodson factors, and which we're later told, I think it was in Ryan, or that is a guide to understanding what is a full and fair consideration. Let's say that we look at the ACCA decision and say they thought hard about it. They gave a full, fair consideration. If we were to do it ourselves, we would find that they were wrong, but they gave it a full, fair and consideration. What should we do in that situation?
Yeah, you cannot merely disagree. You would have to find that the military courts did not give fair and full consideration, but they misapplied the law under those circumstances as well.
Well, you can misapply the law and be wrong and still nevertheless give it full and fair consideration. You could just be wrong. I mean, you used in the other case, the AEDPA example. I think for this purpose, it's a good one because the issue is, I mean, a state court could be wrong as we see it, but still reasonable. I mean, it could have still evaluated this in a reasonable way and come to a conclusion that if we were to do it de novo, we would not do. Now, transport that into the military context. We look at it. We give it full. The military court, Article I court, gave it full and fair consideration. But we sitting here say if we were to do it, we would do it a different way. We think they're wrong. In that situation, what are you telling us we should do?
Our position is the court cannot step in and just say that the military courts got it wrong.
What if we said it's not just wrong, it is egregiously wrong, or it is, we'll put some adjective in there. I mean, I agree, we're not going to be able to micromanage every decision. It's close, but we think we'd come out the other way. But what if we say, one, there's an important constitutional question, and two, they were indefensibly wrong. You're still saying we can't address it then, or we can? I mean,
no.
Obviously, you're saying we could. We have the authority because it's non-jurisdictional, but under the prevailing law, we should not.
Under the guidance that, as I read the long series of cases under the four Dotson factors, that to be able to reach that stage, you would have to find a significant error on the part of the military court under those circumstances that not only raises a substantial constitutional question, but that the military courts erred in its constitutional analysis. And Monk is a good example of that, where they erred in the reasonable doubt instructions, which really struck at the heart of the constitutional question before them. Here, if you're just simply looking at what is the substantial constitutional question, in this case, the only real substantial constitutional issue is whether or not there was a Brady issue. And the courts applied all of the proper analysis under Brady to reach their conclusion. But I would also submit that if the court looks at the second Dotson factor, which gets into the factual allegations, petitioner wants to have this court believe that there were really no factual issues in play. There are a ton of factual issues in play here. And the court didn't agree with their factual allegations. And Judge Holmes, you hit on one of the more significant factual issues. Did he or did he not prove that he took any mefloquine? They looked at and allowed petitioner to put in a lot of evidence below to determine whether or not he could substantiate his claims. And they said he could not. Those are factual allegations that were in play. So the second Dotson factor here, I think, is in play more than the defense wants you to believe under the circumstances, because there are a lot of factual allegations that the court found. And if you look at the supplemental appendix at page 7, they said that the declarations accompanying the enclosures were of uncertain origin, authenticity, and reliability. So they were looking at the factual allegations that the petitioner was putting forward and found them to be rather dubious. And so under the circumstances, there are a lot of facts that are actually would have to have been addressed by the military courts. And it gets me back to my original position. He wants this court to sit exactly where ACCA sat on this particular issue. But he cannot get there simply by saying that this court should look at it differently, because there are no real substantial, to begin with, no substantial constitutional question that opens that door under the Dotson factors. He'd have to establish that the substantial constitutional question, in our opinion, that the military court reviewed did such a poor job of addressing it. So, for example, let's say the military court didn't apply the Brady.
Did such a poor job in its legal analysis or in its interpretation of the factual record?
In its legal analysis, under the question about whether or not the court below, the military court below, was looking at a substantial constitutional question.
Okay, but there's two questions, a legal argument and a review of the factual record. What if we say, yeah, the legal record is kind of unclear, but there's no way on these facts that the ACCA could have come out the way it did. What would happen there in terms of our prudential ability to review?
Well, I think Judge Rebell, if I understand your question, as the court's guidance has said, the court certainly can look at everything that was filed before the military courts. Again, it gets back to the issue that a substantially briefed issue is determined to have been reviewed fairly and considerably. We know that. That case law is
presumed to be reviewed fairly and considerably, but not necessarily competently.
Correctly. Yeah, exactly. I don't disagree with that. Now, again, I to answer that question, I still submit is somewhat of a hypothetical because that we don't that's not this case. There isn't any doubt that the military court, both at ACCA and remember, this is very important. CAF granted petition here. They reviewed it. This wasn't just a situation where CAF or with ACCA, CAF actually granted the petition and reviewed it. Now it was a they summarily denied it, but that doesn't mean that they didn't review it. So you actually had ACCA and CAF review these claims and reject them, which is not generally that common under the circumstances. CAF's not going to grant petitions in every case.
And these these two claims, the methylquin claim and the sort of terrorist witness claim, these are both Brady claims, right? Am I understanding that correctly?
Yes, I believe that that's the vehicle that they are alleging that drives the issue about whether or not the government produced evidence, which, of course, they maintain they did not have access to, as to whether or not that was a legitimate answer under the circumstances. But it gets...
And let me just follow up quickly. And Brady claims are mixed questions of law and fact, right?
They are.
Okay.
And materiality. But I think this may put this in a little bit better perspective. His real claim here is that the military courts erred in not sending this back for a Dubay hearing. And that's really what drives this ultimate question was, you know, in the position he was in, he was trying to present to the military courts that I have all of this evidence and I want this to go back for a Dubay hearing. And so this gets into sort of a critical analysis of the difference between the military courts and the civilian courts. The military courts will then get into a situation where they look at what are called the Ginn factors. And those are the five factors that the court's going to look at to determine whether or not a Dubay hearing is necessary. And so that's unique to the military. And I think, again, that drives a little bit of this discussion here today as to whether or not an Article III court should really sit in a position that it's sitting in when the military looks at this situation under Dubay and the Ginn factors to determine whether or not they want to look at whether or not the defendant or the petitioner has substantiated his claims.
Could he have a meritorious claim or get relief without going back through Dubay, or does he have to have that hearing in order to get ultimate relief?
So again, for him to get the relief that he demands would cause this case, in my opinion, to have to go all the way back to the military system to get to the heart of whether or not he could substantiate these claims that he had actually ingested methylquin. This court certainly, if it was going to reverse, I think would have to reverse it back down to the district court to order that court to reverse it back to the military courts to engage in a Dubay hearing under the circumstances. But the courts, both ACCA and CAF, have determined he did not satisfy the Ginn factors. And again,
Mr. Mack, can I follow that line of reasoning? I just want to make sure I'm understanding. So is it your view then that what we would say in essence is, as to one of the two things, the methylquin or the terrorist witness allegations, we would say that the Brady analysis of ACCA was deficient based upon the allegations and the claim of the information that was withheld, that it was deficient for them to rule that this was not material on its face. In other words, these allegations were made, here's the information, and they concluded it was not material, therefore no Brady violation. We think that that is sufficiently deficient on its face, but we can't ultimately make the determination of resolving the Brady issue we just think that based upon the allegations that it was deficient and remanded back to the court to eventually go back to the military tribunal to determine whether there is substance to these claims that were put forward on the papers. Would that be how it would work?
Yes, at the outer edges, if the court were to rule in favor of petitioner, the government's position is exactly as Your Honor has stated, that it would have to be sent back down to the district court. Judge Lungstrom would have to grant the writ for return to the military courts for an ordering of a Dubé hearing under the circumstances. But I think the court, it'd be very difficult for the court to get there under the circumstances, because it would have to, again, gets back to our larger question, what was it that ACCA and CAF did wrong here that you could say that all four of the Dodson factors have been established in order to grant relief under the circumstances? And our position, again, is you cannot meet at least the second Dodson factor, because the factual allegations, you would have to substitute your opinion about the factual basis of these claims to say that they're true in order to meet that second Dodson factor, of which both ACCA and CAF looked at the factual allegations in depth and rejected them wholly.
Okay, your time is up, Mr. Mag. Is there anything else that we need to know I want to be fair here?
No, I understand that, Judge. This is sort of a very complex question, but I think at the end of the day, I agree with Judge Bell that this is not as complicated as the first case, because, again, you had both military courts, both the inferior court and the superior court, look at this in depth, allowing petitioner to add numerous documents to the record in order to get to the heart of the question he was presenting, and it was rejected in full.
So could it be then concluded, because it certainly did appear that Bales had a full opportunity, really a full opportunity to present stuff. Could we just conclude from that's all he has? That's all there is. So there's no real reason to remand for more evidence, because if he had it, he had had given every opportunity to present it, and he's waived a chance to present anything more. So there's no reason to remand. At that point, then what do? Then we have to say, not remand for more hearing, because the record doesn't show that anything would happen, but rather, was there a error in a finding that he did not prove that he took melflufen, or that caused the response?
That's a very fair position to take, because, again, ACCA had everything before it, allowed petitioner to add all of these documents to the record, reviewed them, and came to the conclusion that was insufficient. So the question presented is, what else does he have? And the answer to that question is nothing. There isn't anything else he can add to the record at this
point. Well, he doesn't even make a proffer. He makes no proffer of proof even now on appeal. Here's some more stuff I would add. And, these two cases have just mushroomed to a quantity quality I had not anticipated. So I'm still trying to get my brain around it all. But it is true that we have no proffer of proof. There's really no reason to remand, because there's nothing in this evidence to suggest that there's anything more than anybody could have done.
That is the government's position, is that there is nothing new presented here that the military courts did not already address. And I cannot understate, again, the fact that both ACCA and CAF reviewed this and rejected their claims.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Mack.
Thank you, Judge.
At the risk of trying the patience of my colleagues severely, Mr. Meyer, this is the only thing I want to know from you now, okay? We've talked a lot about the decision tree, essentially what happens, or the decision route. If we were to rule in your favor, let's say we found that there was some Brady violation, you're muted, what happens? I mean, what does it do? Can we just do that on right now, or is a remand necessary? That's what I want to know. 1 minute.
Your Honor, I believe that counsel for the United States is correct. If you grant the writ, you send it back for a new trial. That's where it goes back, so the melflufen evidence and the terror evidence can be fully fleshed. And Judge Abiel, I have to disagree with you, Your Honor. The proffer has been shown. We are the defense. The United States always had this information and never disclosed it in a timely fashion such that we could have used it at trial and or upon appeal. We had to go find it once we caught the case as appellate counsel. So all of that to say, yes, the requested relief is a new trial. Okay, and that the court can order.
May I then follow up? I mean, Judge Holmes.
Yes, of course. Go ahead.
Yes, the government had to respond, at this point it's getting, we're into the third level of convolution. I'm going to.
All right.
Why, 30 seconds, Judge. I'm happy to answer it.
I think we're going to call it a day. We have a minute, and we've exceeded that time. Thank you, counsel, for your vigorous arguments. And this case is submitted.